It is 11:05 here on 570 News Midday on 570 News and Rogers TV. Thanks so much for being along. Coming up at 11:35, Diana Boll will be joining us, the Executive Director of Victim Services of Waterloo Region. November is Woman Abuse Awareness Month. We'll be chatting about that coming up at 11:35. A Hamilton hospital that lost a legal battle to force an 11-year-old Aboriginal girl to resume cancer treatment says she has, quote, no chance of survival without the care. A judge in Brantford rejected the bid by McMaster Children's Hospital to have the girl apprehended and placed back into chemotherapy. Now, the judge said the girl's family has a constitutional right to opt for traditional medicine. Hospital president Dr. Peter Fitzgerald says the health center has no immediate plans for an appeal, but remains hopeful the girl will return for treatment. Now, the girl, whose name is hidden by a publication ban, was receiving chemo before her mother removed her in mid-September to take her to a Florida clinic for alternative therapy. Now, some First Nation leaders are applauding the decision. Chief Ava Hill of the Six Nations Reserve denies that the family is risking the child's life, saying her mother, quote, loves her to the world and back. And joining me on the line now is Chris Lowry, an assistant professor of social and political philosophy and applied ethics at the University of Waterloo. Thank you so much. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well.
You know, this is such an interesting case to me, Chris, because just that last sentence I read with the chief saying that she doesn't think that the parents are risking the child's life, saying her mother loves her to the world and back. I don't think that's what's up for discussion here, right? I mean, we're not talking, no one is denying that the parents love their daughter.
Absolutely. There's been agreement on every side that this is a loving, caring family trying to make a decision that they think is in the best interest of their child. Yeah.
And I think where a lot of people seem to have a problem with this, Chris, is that people are saying, well, here's what's happening. This 11-year-old girl can't, I mean, obviously make the decision for herself. Mm-hmm. We know that doctors in Hamilton are saying if she stayed in chemo, 90 to 95% chance of survival. They're saying you pull her out, she has no chance of survival. So at what point can or should the government intervene and say, look, if there is a chance for survival, we intervene and we do that?
Yeah, right. So the, in medical ethics, the right to refuse is a kind of central right. But like pretty much any right we have, it has conditions. It's not an absolute right. So what one of the things this case raises is what are the conditions on that right to refuse, when the right to refuse is connected to Aboriginal rights specifically.
Now, why does that matter? Aboriginal rights.
Well, Canadian society has a special commitment to protecting Aboriginal rights that is stronger. It's sort of encoded in our constitution, but also in our sort of beliefs about the matter. That our obligation to protecting and facilitating the ability of Aboriginal people to pass on their culture and preserve their culture. That our commitment to that is stronger than, say, to freedom of religion, which is also strong, but there's a kind of a priority, there's a special commitment with respect to Aboriginal rights.
So if I was placed in the same situation and I pulled my kid out of it and I'm not Aboriginal, that may have been looked at differently?
Yeah. So there are previous cases. The cases that are not identical but similar, having to do with Jehovah's Witness families refusing treatment that requires blood transfusion, right? So in those cases, we would look at sort of the right to pass on religious values to your children, which we think is an important thing and ought to be given, you know, significance, but would say, at least in previous legal decisions, they've drawn a distinction between essential medical treatment and non-essential. So essential would be, is it required to save the life? Is it required to avoid very significant health problems? Right. And
yeah.
If it crosses that line, then an appeal to freedom of religion is not enough to ground a right to refuse. This case is saying that an appeal to Aboriginal rights is enough.
And, I mean, what is your opinion on that matter? I mean, the fact that that's what it's saying. I mean, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm not a legal expert, so I can't speak to the constitutional issues. I've read some of the relevant court documents, but again, I can't speak to that as a legal expert. My thought is that yes, the importance of parents being able to pass on cultural values to their kids is really important. Any kind of values, whether they're religious, non-religious, any kind of thing like that. But I would want to say, sort of bottom line, that we ought to pass those values on in a way that preserves the child's future ability to either follow them or reject them in the future, or question them or modify them, right? So if we want to put a qualification on the right to refuse, where we say you can't do that if the child's going to die, we can explain that in terms of we want to preserve the child's ability to decide for themselves later on whether those beliefs are worth living or dying for.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my thought in this case. Now, one thing that's complicated about the case is it's not entirely clear that the parents are making a choice where they see themselves as putting their culture before their child's life, right? So specifically, the lawyer from the Children Aid Society, this is from an article in CBC, right?
Yeah.
Said that the family hasn't completely ruled out chemotherapy if it becomes necessary, right? In a kind of refusing blood transfusion kind of case, this is a religion before life. In this kind of case, I'm not sure that that's the best description of it.
I see. We're on the line with Chris Lowry, assistant professor of social and political philosophy and applied ethics at the University of Waterloo. So, I know you're not a legal expert, but in terms of the precedent that this sets, even ethically speaking, I mean, are other people are going to be able to cite this case now and say, look, this happened for this person?
Yeah, so, I think any case is going to set some kind of legal precedent. One of the things that I found a little bit confusing about the case was looking at some of the things that they looked at, some of the cases it cited, right? So it cited a case called R.V. Sparrow from 1990, as well as R.V. Vanderpeet from 96. The Sparrow case was about fishing rights, right? Aboriginal fishing rights.
Mm-hmm.
And it set out they called it the Sparrow test, right? And that's what it's sort of referred to in later documents that were cited in the judge's decision. And the Sparrow test said this, you know, first you need to establish whether there's an Aboriginal right. Then once you've established that, you need to see whether the current legislation from the government infringes on the right. And then if it does infringe on the right, you have to ask, is that infringement justified, right? So there's a three-step, there's supposed to be a three-step process in this Sparrow test. The judgment in this case refers to that case and establishes that there is an Aboriginal right to pursue traditional medicine, or at least seems to, right? Seems to me,
right?
As a layperson reading the ruling, but I don't see where it then goes on to step two and step three of the Sparrow test,
right?
So, for me, just as a layperson reading this, I found that confusing, because one way of reading the current ruling, and I think it's probably a misreading, is to suggest that it's saying that there's an absolute right to refuse medical treatment based on Aboriginal rights, whereas there's only a qualified right or a conditional right to refuse medical treatment on the basis of religious reasons. I don't think that's the right interpretation, but I don't know what the right interpretation is. There's a bit of ambiguity there.
See, where I'm struggling with this, Chris, is that at the end of the day, we have an 11-year-old girl who, as doctors say, will die if she doesn't get chemotherapy. And the Aboriginal right aside, that's the issue at hand, that we have an 11-year-old girl that will die, according to doctors, if she doesn't get chemotherapy. So, citing an Aboriginal right just complicates it even further to me, because anyone else that isn't Aboriginal, perhaps the decision would have been different.
from what I can tell, based on again my layperson reading of the other legal cases, yeah, it sounds like that's the case. And so
that's kind of where we are.
that's where we are. Yeah.
So what type of case? What would happen in a case? What would need to happen? Let me rephrase that. What would need to happen in a case where the government would step in?
Yeah. So where they stepped in the past there's a couple cases of parents refusing chemotherapy on religious grounds. Usually it's chemotherapy not always, but sometimes it's been in conjunction with in connection with blood transfusion. And they don't always apprehend the child and force treatment. But in the cases where they do, it depends on how likely the treatment is at the sort of risk-benefit ratio, right? So in cases where the likelihood of survival with treatment is sort of 60% or above, although there's not like a sharp line, but, you know, a good chance, historically that's been enough to say this is a child in need of protection. If the parents are refusing chemo, then this is we're going to put that sort of kicks in the qualification on their right to refuse. So then the children are provided treatment in a forced way.
Right.
But in cases where there's a lower case, like a 30% chance, then they haven't done that. So that's sort of that's the test. They talk about whether it's essential treatment, whether it's a high chance of survival, a low chance of risk.
And in this particular case, I mean, we're hearing 95% chance of living.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right, Chris, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, that is Chris Lowry right there, an assistant professor, social and political philosophy of applied ethics, the University of Waterloo. Over to you now. Did the court make the right decision for this 11-year-old girl in this particular case? Phone lines are open. We'll take your calls and emails straight ahead on Rogers TV and 570 News.
Is it required to save a life? Is it required to avoid very significant health problems? Crosses that line, then an appeal to freedom of religion is not enough to ground a right to refuse. This case is saying that an appeal to Aboriginal rights is enough.
570 Midday continues with Eric Drost.
And that is Chris Lowry, assistant professor of social and political philosophy and applied ethics at the University of Waterloo. We are talking about a case where an Ontario judge has ruled that the family has the right to pull an 11-year-old Aboriginal girl out of chemotherapy treatment and send her to Florida, a clinic that deals with alternative treatment. Even though doctors at McMaster's Children's Hospital are saying that, quote, this girl has no chance of survival without chemotherapy and has a 90 to 95% chance of survival with chemotherapy. Did the court make the right decision for this 11-year-old girl? Phone lines are open, 519-570-2545 locally, out of town, 1-800-570-5715, *570 by cell, and by email, eric@570news.com. Good morning, Ken. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning. I don't even know where to begin. It's just absolutely disgusting that the courts don't have the kahunas to say, no, enough's enough here. The scientific evidence is just so darn overwhelming. I mean, we're going to Florida, and I suppose that's also on the taxpayer's dime, whereas you or I couldn't get OHIP to pay that kind of fee going down there. But here you're going to have a child, 11-year-old precious child, who's kind of in the middle of a tug of war between government and her traditional rights.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are into whatever probably amounts to smudging or smoking, smoke wafting into the face, and that's going to cure you. It's akin to me of the snake culture down in the southern U.S. where they believe that the actual snake worshiping will save them. I'm just beyond words. It's just incredible. I mean, there's a lot of great things about the Aboriginal heritage, but it's a cherry-picking time once again, and I think the courts probably went the easy route instead of doing the right thing in fear of a backlash of some type of closure or some type of major protest. And it's just getting to be too much every time you turn around. It's cherry picking. I mean, what is convenient and good today of the Western culture is great. But we don't like that piece of it, so let's revert to here. It's cherry picking. It's not all in one way or the other. It's just it's overwhelming, and I fear that this young child is going to be made a sacrificial lamb, and it's disgusting. And at the end of the day, if she does pass, then who's going to be held accountable for that?
Well, yeah, thanks, Ken. Appreciate the phone call. And when we spoke with Chris Lowry, he said, you know, that this Aboriginal right played into this decision, obviously. To me, it's really tough because if, you know, I'm not Aboriginal, and if I pulled my child out of chemotherapy and because I thought for whatever reason that an alternative medicine could save her, I'm not sure that the same decision would have came from the courts like it did in this particular case. And at the end of the day, we're dealing with an 11-year-old girl with leukemia. And if she does pass, and doctors are saying that she has a 90 to 95% chance of survival with chemo, I mean, who do we look to then? This is Grant on the line. Go ahead, Grant.
With what you just said, you said you don't know if it would, if the decision would be for yourself too. I don't know why it wouldn't be.
Because I don't have an Aboriginal right. That's what it comes down to. That's what this decision, according to Chris Lowry and some of the other legal experts that have spoken out, have said, that there is an Aboriginal right that is held. It's kind of like a religious right or religious belief. But what I'm saying is that at what point does all of that go away? Because the fact is that we have an 11-year-old that has leukemia and doctors say she can be saved. And no one is questioning, because people automatically resort to, well, you're questioning that the mother and the father loved. No one's questioning that the mother loves her daughter. The mother can believe that this alternative medicine could save her. And maybe it can. You know, maybe there have been cases where it has or whatever. Okay, but what I'm saying is that here we are in Canada in 2014 and we have doctors saying that chemo will save this girl. So at what point does the government step in and say, we're going to save an 11-year-old girl? That's what I'm asking. On the email, Andre says, absolutely not. The court should have stepped in and taking this child away. There is a 90 to 95% chance that this child can survive. We have to stop treating these people like they're God. Do you really want the law where everybody is treated differently just because of your race and skin or color? Think about it. Treat everybody the same with the law. The law is blind. It doesn't see who you are. It just judges you on what you do. That from Andre. This is from Laura. Hi, Eric. Yes, yes, yes. The court made the right decision. This news made my day on Friday when I heard the judge's decision. There is no person that knows better than the mother what is best for her child. Therefore, she should be the one deciding what treatment is best for well-being of the child. I have a huge problem with that, Laura. I have a huge problem with that statement. There's no one that knows better for the child. See, that is the issue here. No one is questioning that the mother doesn't love her child, her daughter. But doctors, frankly, know better in this particular case about survival. And if they're saying that chemo will save your daughter, a 90 to 95% chance that your daughter will live, they, in this particular case, know better than the mother who believes that eating a raw food diet and taking vitamins and healing yourself, as this clinic in Florida states it can do, it teaches their patients to heal themselves. In this particular case, I have to side with the doctors knowing a little bit better. And before we get going, Sandra says, hi, Eric, I'm Aboriginal. No medicine is perfect. Nobody knows what medicine can save her, whether it's Aboriginal or not. All right, 10:28 here on 570 News Midday. Coming up, we speak about Woman Abuse Awareness Month on Rogers TV and 570 News. And welcome back. It is 11:35. Coming up at noon, Lorna Vanderhey, Canada's leading women's health expert, joins us on the line to take all of your health questions. Some questions already coming in by email. You can get those in now, eric@570news.com. If you have any questions for Lorna, that's coming up between noon and 1. So 2/3 of female sexual assault victims who responded to a detailed survey said they lacked confidence in the criminal justice system, pointing to a need for better support services. That according to a new federal study. Many of these women cited their shaky faith in the justice system as a reason for not reporting a sexual attack to police. Allegations of sexual assault against former CBC radio host John Gomeshi and accusations of harassment involving two Liberal MPs have sparked widespread discussion about how society handles issues of sexual violence directed at women. And we're also hearing of numerous allegations now against Bill Cosby, where women have come forward claiming sexual assault and rape. And this leads to the broader conversation about violence against women, as November is Woman Abuse Awareness Month. And on November 25th, that is International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. And locally, Victim Services of Waterloo Region has a number of resources available. And joining me on the line right now is Diana Boll, the Executive Director of Victim Services of Waterloo Region. Thanks so much for doing this. How are you?
I am well, thanks. And yourself?
I'm doing well. So what exactly is Victim Services of Waterloo Region?
Well, first and foremost, Victim Services of Waterloo Region, we're funded by the Ministry of the Attorney General, and what we're funded to do specifically is to provide crisis intervention teams when they're requested by the police or other emergency services when there's a victim of a crime or a tragic circumstance, such as suicide, and the police feel that this person could use the emotional supports and interventions that our trained volunteers can provide.
So they point them to you, and then you point them to someone else?
Well, in fact, what happens on scene, if the police call, if the police call us out, is we will dispatch a team of volunteers to go out and deal with folks right in that very moment of their tragedy or just in the aftermath of a crime. So they have that critical emotional intervention piece readily available to them.
Oh, so you're on scene if need
be.
Yes,
okay. We are on scene if needed, absolutely.
How many calls do you receive on, say, annual basis?
On an annual basis, we receive anywhere between 450 and 550 calls, and that's calls on scene and also includes people who self-refer. And those are the folks who call in and that we can do that piece that you mentioned, which is where we can redirect them to all sorts of community resources.
So that's how many calls you receive, but the police, I mean, they receive a lot more calls.
Absolutely. Yeah. In the case of domestic violence, they received, I believe last year, they received over 6,000 calls.
So over 6,000 calls, and you only receive about 400, you were saying?
Yeah, it sort of works out that way. It depends on if the police feel or if the victim even wants victim services
right.
involved, and sometimes they don't, and of course, it's always their choice. We never impose ourselves upon people.
Is that part of the issue? I mean, not that you don't impose yourself, but the fact, I mean, it's clearly an issue that some people feel like they shouldn't reach out, right?
That's correct. I would agree with you on that, in fact, that there's a lot of serious underreporting that goes on for domestic violence and for violence against women in general, including the numbers that you were talking about at the outset. There's anywhere between sort of 25 and 33% roughly of people. Those are the numbers of calls that we think are reported to the police. And so if you think that 6,000 is only 33% of the whole number, that's a whole volume of people that are just, they either think it's not important enough, perhaps it was, in their opinion, just verbal abuse, or they just don't want the police to be involved for whatever reasons of their own.
Why do you think people don't report it?
Well, I think that sometimes women are afraid, and it's not just, let me be clear, it's not just women who are victims
right.
of intimate partner violence, it includes men. And I think sometimes they're afraid because what the perpetrator will do is say, if you call the police, I'll actually kill you. So instead of maybe just getting a beating, which just sounds appalling, they're afraid for their lives. They're afraid for their children's lives. There are so many different reasons that people don't report. Another one is shame. People feel very ashamed that they've somehow allowed this to happen, and victims need to understand that they didn't allow anything to happen and that if they can reach out and get some counseling and get some supports, that there is another side to life.
bit of a catch-22, though, because how do they come to that realization without speaking to you?
Well, that's exactly it. And there are a whole bunch of supports out in the community. I mean, Women's Crisis Services, obviously, is the main one, the Family Violence Project. And we try to get, and they try to get the message out that all calls are confidential. We don't report to the police if somebody calls in on their own and says, I think I may be in trouble, unless it's an emergency situation or there are children involved. And then, of course, we have to report to the police. We're required by law to do so. But if they can just make that first step, then it's often that piece that can connect them to the next piece. And it can be a very slow process in terms of healing and in terms of understanding all about woman abuse, because it really is, it's not just they feel they're alone and they feel that this couldn't possibly be happening to anyone else and they're not alone and it does happen to other people and there is help out there.
Are you surprised at all by this federal study that says two-thirds of female sexual assault victims, and in this case it's sexual assault, but we're talking about violence in general, but I mean, in this case, the sexual assault victims responded saying that, that they're not confident in the criminal justice system, which is part of the reason why they don't reach out?
I think that that's slowly changing. I can't say that I'm entirely surprised by that, given that the criminal justice system in the past has not always been kind to women who report sexual assault. There was a lot of victim blaming. There still is a lot of victim blaming. There still is a lot of, why were you there by yourself? Why were you wearing that? That kind of thing. I think that in Waterloo Region, at least, that we have our police services much more open and much more, what's the word I'm looking for? It's just an easier service to report to, I think. And I think that there are some places where, especially for perhaps First Nations women, oftentimes the perpetrator will have friends. It's a very small community, so they have friends in the police force, so they don't want to report there. And then when you get into the entire criminal justice system itself, it can be enormously crushing for a victim to have gone through, to have had the police listen to her story, to have done the investigation, laid the charges, have the Crown present the case, and then have the judge turn around and say something along the lines of, well, it's not a big deal. All
right.
He did was grab your butt, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I can see how that could be crushing for sure. And then you hear stories like that, and then if you are in a situation, well, you're less likely to
That's exactly
to
it.
Report
it really
it.
Is that catch-22 spoke about.
We're on the line with Diana Bull, Executive Director, Victim Services of Waterloo Region. So what kind of programs do you have in place that you can highlight for us today?
Sure. Well, we actually we have several different programs that we offer, but there are three main ones that we particularly offer to victims of intimate partner violence, criminal stalking, harassment, and things like that. One of them is our Victim Quick Response Program, and what happens with that is that's actually financial assistance to a victim of a crime who has, let's say, had their door kicked in. This could also be break and enter. This doesn't have to be intimate partner violence. But let's say they've had their door kicked in, and in order to make their home safe, they need the lock replaced. They might not have insurance. They can get in touch with us as long as they have the occurrence number, and this has been reported to the police. And in this case, we have to have police reporting. Then we can help them access a locksmith, and we'll pay for it.
Okay. In terms of, I mean, ending this, this is, of course, the golden question, but what is, I mean, how do we end this? How do we put an end to this kind of violence?
Well, I think one of the really interesting things that's come up recently with the CBC and Jan Gomeshi and then also with Bill Cosby and all of those things is people are beginning to see that it really is widespread and it really is insidious. And that if these women who have come out in public and have said, these entertainers, these people, these high-profile names have done these things, that that encourages other people to come forward. So we get past that piece where sometimes a woman or a man feels that they're just not going to get the satisfaction they need. But I think we also need to realize that violence against women pervades society. And we just, you know, we see it every day, and it's not just video games, and it's not just music videos. you see it on a woman walking down the street and she gets catcalled, and, you know, people will say, oh, well, that's just harmless, it's just admiring her. Well, you know what? Women have the right to walk down the street. That's verbal harassment. I think that we also need to realize that women have been, for generations, treated as less than. How long has it been since we had the right to vote? I mean, this is, it's a long process, but I think that there are enough, or there is enough momentum behind what we're realizing now in terms of getting it out in society and allowing ourselves to realize that it's not just a few bad people doing bad things to women, but it is a societal issue.
With the calls you deal with,
mm-hmm.
how many of those are against women and how many of those are against men?
I have personally dealt with one male victim and the rest have been female. So I would say right now it's about 90% to 10%.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I mean, and for a male victim of intimate partner violence, it's even more devastating in some ways, and that's not to demean a woman or her experience in any way. But if you're a man and your female partner, or perhaps your male partner if you're in that kind of relationship, that's incredibly difficult. And it's for the flip side of the coin reason that women have been treated as less than, is men have had these expectations put on them where they have to be manly and they have to be strong and they have to, you know, how can you let a woman beat you up? And that's incredibly unfair, because when we're talking about intimate partner violence, it's about power and control. And to say to one person, how can you let that happen? You're not letting it happen. Somebody else is doing it to you.
Very quickly, before I let you go, what about education from an earlier age, say in the school system?
Absolutely. Education from an earlier age is really critical to get people, to get kids understanding that when you say things like, you run like a girl, that's actually suggesting that girls are less than. So let's think about that. I think the universities are doing a terrific job now with their consent campaigns. And I think that as time passes on, we should hopefully see the results of that in lessening of violence against women.
Thank you, Diana. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Diana Bull right there, the Executive Director of Victim Services of Waterloo Region. What is the answer to ending violence against women? Or, you know, it goes both ways, as you heard Diana talk about. But right now, the things that she's dealing with, about 90% of the cases are violence against women, 10% against men. But what is the answer? Is it education? We'll take your calls and emails straight ahead on Rogers TV and 570 News.
They're afraid for their lives. They're afraid for their children's lives. There are so many different reasons that people don't report. Another one is shame. People feel very ashamed that they've somehow allowed this to happen, and victims need to understand that they didn't allow anything to happen, and that if they can reach out and get some counseling and get some support, that there is another side to life.
570 Midday continues with Eric Drost.
And that is Diana Bull, the Executive Director of Victim Services of Waterloo Region. It is 11:53 here on 570 News Midday. November is Woman Abuse Awareness Month. And November 25th is International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. And Victim Services of Waterloo Region has a number of resources available. What is the answer here to ending violence against women? And to be clear, and as Diana mentioned, it goes both ways. But of course, we know that the vast majority of these types of cases, we're dealing with violence against women. And I think it's a good thing that we're talking about it. And part of the reason why we're talking about it is because we have a couple of high-profile cases that have been in the news, of course, as of late with Gian Gomeshi, and now with Bill Cosby and the two Liberal MPs that were kicked out of caucus. So it's kind of brought this widespread conversation on, which I think is a great thing. But what is the answer? Is it education? Will education end violence against women? Phone lines are open. 519-570-2545. Locally, out of town, 1-800-570-5715. Star 570 by cell and by email, eric@570news.com. This is from Michael. I agree with your guest. But some of the clothes women wear in the summer, no wonder why they get catcalls. It's like they want to flaunt their body. Just a thought, Michael. Yeah, but you know, Michael, you still have a right to walk down the street, no matter what you're wearing, without getting catcalled. You still have that right. Here's a video of a woman. Not sure if you've seen it, but there's a video of a woman in New York. She takes, there's clearly someone walking in front of her with a camera on their back, videotaping her as she walks behind this person. And I think she ended up walking like 10 hours in New York City and recorded the amount of cat calls and everything that she received during that time. I mean, and some of the things seem harmless to people, but a lot of the experts are saying that it's not harmless. I mean, why should anyone have to walk down the street and get whistled at or, you know, be asked how they're doing? But, you know, in the sense, right? You know, it's not like, hi, how are you? It's like, you know, how you doing? Like that type of thing. So, I mean, with the catcalls, everyone should and does have the right to walk down the street without getting catcalled. And a lot of people think it's harmless. And that's just one portion of this, right? I mean, we're talking about violence in many different aspects. It's a catch-22. A lot of victims don't know that a lot of these services exist, so they don't reach out. I mean, if someone is a victim and they don't reach out for many reasons, because they're afraid, or they know that the system, as this federal study showed, that 2/3 of female sexual assault victims responded this, say that they lacked confidence in the criminal justice system. Well, if you don't reach out in the first place, you might not know what's available to you. So it's a bit of a catch-22. How are they supposed to know without reaching out? And I'm not sure what the answer is. I don't think anybody has the answer. I mean, I guess all we can do is talk about it and keep pointing people to the right, in the right direction, and say that there's nothing wrong with reaching out. But other than that, I don't know what the answer is to stop this. I mean, when I hear a stat like over 6,000 calls just locally here in Waterloo Region last year of domestic violence, I mean, it is happening here locally. It's happening everywhere. But some people, I mean, it's not a comfortable conversation. Some people may not realize how often it happens here. So out of those 6,000 calls, just over 400 were reported to Victim Services of Waterloo Region. So that needs to climb somehow, and I'm not sure what the answer is. I don't think anybody has that answer. 11:57 here on 570 News Midday. Coming up, Lorna Vanderhaeghe, Canada's leading women's health expert, joins me from noon to one. She's here taking all of your questions, your health questions. You can get me an email right now, eric@570news.com. We'll take your calls, and we'll look at your emails as well. Coming up next, you're on Rogers TV and 570 News.